ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, Book Show listeners. It's the producer of the show, Sarah Lestrange here, and I want to let you know about an exciting opportunity for the budding writers out there. ABCRN's Big Weekend of Books is coming up in June for 2 days of the best local and international authors in conversation with RN presenters. It's on your airwaves and on ABC Listen. And as part of the goodies on offer, you'll also have the chance to take part in a special and exclusive memoir writing masterclass. It's with Australian author Chris Neen, whose books include Fat Girl Dancing and The Three Burials of Lottie Neen. To find out more, head to the RN website, search for the Big Weekend of Books, and look for the Memoir Writing Masterclass competition. Entries close on Wednesday, the 7th of June, so be quick. And now it's time for the book show.
Hello, this is The Book Show. My name is Claire Nichols, and today you and I are spending time with two unforgettable characters, Lost Boys, finally getting their moment in the sun. Two of the world's best authors have turned their attention to boys who society has failed in some way. Later, Barbara Kingsolver will tell you about her beloved Demon Copperhead, a boy orphaned by America's opioid crisis. And first up, the British writer Max Porter is taking us on the run with Shy, a teenager who can't explain his own troubled outbursts. Now, Max Porter's work is experimental and edgy. He's best known for Grief is the Thing with Feathers and Lanny, which was longlisted for the Booker. In this new novel, his troubled protagonist is breaking out of the last chance school where he lives. The book and the boy are both called Shy.
The rucksack is shockingly heavy. The floorboards complain. He checks again. The spliff is diagonal snug in the empty embassy box. The daytime check is a half dream away. The room is molten soft, tempting, jumpy. The rucksack is shockingly heavy. It's 3:13 a.m. It's a full bag of rocks. Of course it's heavy. The average flint is about 600 million years old, said Steve. Snapping point, creaking straps, Walkman ready, Pandemonium Andromeda Tour, Plymouth 1994, tape one, Randall back-to-back Kenny Ken, express how you're feeling. Jungle, the pinnacle, the amen, almighty, a way of life.
Max Porter, thank you for joining me. I just love the way you read your work.
Oh, thanks. I hope I always will write books that are a pleasure to read aloud. I think there's something maybe about, I don't know, maybe I'm after some kind of musicality that means they're fun to read aloud. I don't know. But yeah, it's a pleasure to read.
It's great that you mentioned music straight up, because I was thinking about you as a teenage boy. The last time we spoke, when we were talking about your book, The Death of Francis Bacon, you told me, as a teenager, you always had headphones in, listening to electronic music and thinking about nuclear bombs.
Oh, yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's the one.
Let's start with the bombs. Why were you always thinking about nuclear bombs?
Well, I suppose being born, you know, when I was born, but perhaps I belong slightly to the generation above me in that regard, because my generation tend to sort of not think about it. My generation seemed to be kind of cloaked in denial as regards the nuclear bomb. So I suppose it was from hanging out with anxious people from the generation above me, who, you know, the kind of generation that would have been protesting at Greenham Common and things like that in the UK. So just the sort of the scale, the existential scale of the problem of having these weapons and the inevitability that they'll be used. And I guess, you know, learning at school about like mutually assured destruction and thinking, that's funny that we're all just going about our business not thinking about that. But of course, to think about it every day would be to go to go mad. But then, of course, one does go a bit mad when one's a teenager. And I'd like to harness that madness now and turn it into literature. So I suppose that kind of the problem of what the world has become, and, you know, Primo Levi's thing about not being able to write poetry after the Holocaust, and those sorts of senses of how we reconcile the beautiful things in this world and the kind of inexplicable miracle of consciousness and being alive with the atrocity of humanity's worst deeds, and just always trying to keep those two things in tension and looking at finding art, and as you said with the Francis Bacon book, finding art that speaks to that extraordinary tension. And music gets you to a place quicker, you know, it gets you to that place immediately. And I've always wondered whether art and literature can do the same thing.
So you were born in 1981, for context. The music you were listening to when you were mooching around and thinking about nuclear bombs, what were you listening to in those headphones when you were this teenage boy?
I had more eclectic tastes than my character Shai does. I listened to a lot of blues and folk music and jazz and hip hop and African music, because that's my great passion, and reggae and dub. But into this moment of kind of late 90s jazz and trip hop, and the Bristol scene was emerging, what we would now call the sound of drum and bass, jungle and drum and bass. And I got really, really into that at around about this time. The kind of the darker early metalheads and V Recordings, Fotech, Source Direct, these sorts of people, the kind of dark industrial, sort of futuristic sounds of British-made drum and bass. And that is good headphones music, and was a kind of like portal to a different world for me, really. And I was being kind of drip-fed it by my older brother. So he would come back from record shops and play me this stuff, and it felt totally miraculous and otherworldly and very much in tune with the kind of fear and anxiety and rage and like dips and troughs of my teenage mind.
When you were this age, were you also already a wannabe writer, Max?
No, I wasn't really. That all came a bit later and was quite accidental. I think if you'd asked me what I want to do at this age, I would have probably said musician. I was playing in a jazz band and we were starting to experiment. You know, our drummer was starting to play breakbeats and try and emulate this kind of sound that I'm describing. And I think I would have said I want to go around the world making music. Which I suppose I might still say.
it's still
the number one dream.
You just made music for us when you read from your book. You're just doing it in a different way.
Maybe. Well, that is probably the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. So thank you. I'll accept that.
Right.
You know, but I listened to someone on the radio the other day, and they're talking about a Colombian musician, and they're saying, you know, he was in his 80s and they'd seen him play, you know, for sort of like five decades, they'd seen this person play. And they said every time he looked down at his instrument, he smiled. You know, over a course of a long and sort of extraordinary career, the defining characteristic for them as a viewer of this person had been that he had always smiled down at his instrument. He had loved his instrument. And I do think writers should have that same relationship with the 26 keys of the alphabet. We should be joyful and musical about not necessarily making musical work or work about music, or not even performing it, but just a sense of rapture and awe at the capability of the language. It should be a joy to play this instrument. So yeah, I'll accept your likeness between the two and think of myself more as a musician from this day hence.
Hooray. Do you feel that joy when you sit down at the keyboard, Max?
Yeah, I do. I really, really do. And especially when it cuts through unplanned, you know, when I'm feeling like, you know, as a British person right now, you know, there's a great deal of anger and despair and disillusionment and shame and you know, a lot to worry about, like there is for everybody. And the sense of when I sit down at the blank piece of paper, what Max will I meet? How cluttered will the various different Maxes be? And will I be able to achieve anything? You know, will I be able to tune in, as it were, and hear the sound of this instrument? And I'm always just so delighted how instant that is. The minute I put on my headphones and open a blank page, I'm right there. And I feel like not just a deep joy, but like a sort of borderless, frontierless excitement. Like, I love to write and I love the unexpectedness of it and the surprises, and I love getting better at it. Like, I loved last year I wrote a novel that I binned, and I loved that. It felt like doing you know, doing 150 hours of really, really intense practice that no one will ever hear, but definitely made me a better musician. I'm just running with the musician analogy now, sorry.
No, I love it. You said you put on headphones to write. Are you listening to music while you write as well?
Mm-hmm. Always, yeah. Well, not always, but yeah, I like to have music. I particularly wordless and beatless music. I listen to a lot of ambient and classical music when I'm writing, just to kind of achieve a sort of emotional relationship between myself and other sounds. And then when I need silence, the silence is all the more startling, and I can really use the silence in a different way as well. And then with Shy, you know, because Shy's specific obsession is late 90s jungle and drum and bass, when I went back and edited the novel, I edited it with that music playing loudly, because I had some I had some guys fixing our roof. It turned out they did a really bad job, actually. They're basically cowboys. But at the time, I was getting on well with them and taking them cups of tea. And they were all also very into 90s drum and bass. So they were extremely happy to have this music booming out of the house while I was editing the novel. And that works really well, because the book should be infused with it. The book should have a kind of inherent quality of 170 BPM bass line and clatter that I hope is sort of palpable to the reader. Even if they don't know that music, I hope they feel that it kind of bangs along at that pace and is sort of infectious in that regard.
Wow. So the book is called Shy. It's about a troubled boy. His name is Shy. It's a really touching exploration of a moment in his life. Before we get too deep into who Shy is, I just wanted to talk about the word borstal. It comes up a few times in this book. Can you tell listeners here in Australia what a borstal is, Max?
Yeah, like a young offenders institution, a junior prison. And some of these boys have been to borstal, and some of them are threatened with it. And what this school is colloquially called Last Chance, but that's what the boys themselves call it. A judge has decided that instead of sending these kids to prison, they will get a last chance at a progressive educational establishment where they're not locked in. They're there of their own free will, but it is a school, but they're there by legal decree. So it's a sort of somewhere in between a school and a prison, which has very, very, sophisticated and reformative intent. It's rehabilitative. It's supposed to be a good thing for these boys, instead of just locking them up and throwing away the key.
Okay. And in this place, we have Shy. Who is he?
Well, he's a kind of blank space upon which we are all invited to project our unhappy teenager, i.e. ourself or someone else. But practically speaking, he is a white, middle-class, disaffected, suburban teenager from the late 90s in the UK. He's not particularly tall, he's not particularly good looking, he's not particularly clever, but he's had good advantages in life. His mother would constantly attack him with a kind of litany of the advantages that he has had and squandered. He's been expelled from two schools, he's been arrested several times, he's done one very, very bad violent thing, and he's done several pretty bad acts of destruction and violence. And this is his attempt to not go to prison. This is his last attempt in education before he's on his final warning, both from society and from his parents as well.
I mean, he obviously has some sort of rage within him. Do you know where that comes from, Max?
I think there's several answers to that question. In the book, no, I never create a trauma, because I didn't want a trauma and effect relationship in this book. I don't quite buy that in literature or in life, and I didn't want to have readers thinking in a kind of diagnostic way about what had happened in Shy's childhood that would explain the way he's behaving in his teenage years, because I don't think that explanation always fits the bill. And I wanted to sort of raise the question of whether that kind of interpretive thinking is helpful with young people. But also I wanted to get at that sort of the sense that actually this disaffected youth, particularly of that time, if you think about kind of like grunge music in America and the kind of hordes of like of white, angry, self-harming teenagers who kind of couldn't handle their privilege and couldn't handle learning about white supremacy or inequality or colonialism without it sort of turning back into a kind of destructive rage and pain and on the body as well, a kind of like violence, both as art and entertainment and spectacle, but also like the banality of the self-harming privileged child, right? This sort of sense that there's nowhere in the world for me to go. And you know, and cultural theorists have written, you know, far better than I ever could about why that happens and some of the sort of symptoms of that happening on a social level. But I just wanted to dial down into one person. Like my analogy for it has been that if there's a tree in the forest, I just chose one random tree, not even a very special or interesting or old or beautiful tree, just a tree. And I cut it open and chose one ring. And then from one ring, I took just one inch, you know, 3 hours in the life of this person, and then went into it in a kind of molecular level to look at what the nutrient base is, what the weather is, what the things either side of it are, what does it look like if you hold it up to the light? And some of it looks pretty ugly. But my contention with this book is that some of it also looks incredibly universal and beautiful and worth loving, you know, both for itself and on our terms now, you know, 30 years into the future.
So you're really drilling down on a moment, and you're saying you don't want to get bogged down in a backstory. But do you feel for a boy like Shai that there is somewhere where he's been let down by a system or a process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about mapping it beyond his immediate life. Like, I don't think his mum's particularly let him down. I feel for him. There are things there for you to look at and think, maybe that's it. Like the absence of his biological father or certain sort of strained and, you know, sort of certain psychosexual things going on or whatever, you know, odd things happen in all human life. But if there's a baddie of the piece, if there's someone who has let us down, it's the ideological imperatives of late capitalism. I fully expect a reader in 2023 to look at that and they don't even need to know much about me or even to know much about this country, but I would be pointing the finger fairly unequivocally at the conservatives, at conservative government, at the choices that would choose to say shut down an institution like Last Chance or take 250 million quid out of the social care budget and put it into nuclear missiles, you know, they rear their head again in my thoughts. Or, you know, would have a society where we've got I think we've got 70 new billionaires or something in the UK now, but we've got more people eating out of food banks or more people, you know, more children living below the poverty line than we have since Victorian times. You know, this is a sickening. It's an abandonment of the moral compass, and it's a total derangement of civilization's aims, which is to care for its vulnerable. And so Shai is both railing against that, and him and his friends are the product of that. Like now, for example, in the UK, you know, they're bringing in a law to stop children loitering. So teenagers are no longer allowed to loiter in a park, which means go to a park. And they're trying to ban, you know, nitrous oxide, you know, that kind of anti-drug hysteria that we saw in the Reagan era, as well as kind of back in this sort of zombified modern Tory Britain. But like, they've closed all the youth clubs. So where are these kids supposed to go? And I find that heartbreaking. And I just, that sometimes I think we listen to the rage and the disillusionment of teenagers and we go, oh, well, they're teenagers, they'll get over it. And what I wanted to do is suggest that we shouldn't get over that. We should hear it because it is an authentic and at times massively insightful howl against the way we live now, which is frankly correct. Like the way we live now isn't right. You know, we all get used to it in different ways. And certainly by the time we're adults and we're more complicit in it, we've got our mortgages, we've got our pensions, we've got our kind of, you know, we're sort of strapped into the kind of Apple Watch, you know, lifestyle cult. And actually, when teenagers say that that is messed up, they're right. It is messed up. And we can hear them a little better than we currently do, I think. And I would say the same for, you know, I'd say the same for many different people in society, but the kind of othering instinct to just say, well, you're going through this now, but by the time you're my age, you'll kind of land in this narrow moral trough whereby you actually think this is all fine. It's ludicrous. So he is all of us, and he is all people outside of the kind of self-satisfied sort of one destination train of society who's just saying, hang on a minute, this is, I feel unhappy about this. And as it happens, he's really unhappy. You know, he's locked in, he's profoundly unhappy and is having suicidal thoughts. And I also didn't want to belittle that. I don't want to judge him for that. I want to hear him. And I want the people in the book to hear him and understand him and love him, despite the fact that he's potentially making the most difficult decision of all.
Yeah. I did really care for this boy in this book. You were speaking there, Max, a lot about children today. Why set this back in the 90s?
No phones.
Really?
I'm not qualified. Well, there's a few reasons, obviously. Like, I'm interested in a sort of recent historical novel and how you can kind of break the rules of this historical novel. And I was interested in doing a really specific cultural deep dive on the music and stuff. But basically, yeah, I think if I wanted to write about an unhappy teenager now, I don't think I'm well equipped to do so, because the means of communication have changed so profoundly. Like, it is a different world now, you know. And so some of the focus of my study in this book, so like bullying, which I liken in the book to a kind of hyper flirting between them, a kind of violent flirting between these boys. Like, that's a totally different art form now with mobile phones. Music has completely changed. The way, you know, means of distribution and reception of music's totally changed. I think even a place like this Last Chance School, I really don't think many places like this exist anymore. Certainly some of the social carers and foster parents I'm talking to on tour for this book are standing up saying, I used to work in an institution like that and it was shut down. So I think the kind of recent past as a place to hold a sort of startling mirror up to the present was a useful device for me to get out of. Also, I don't want to essay around my own anger. Like, I have to take this all away from me. Like, I'm sort of talking to you today as if these are all things that I thought about when I was writing, but really I didn't. I just tried to build Shy and remove me as much as possible. Any moment when it seemed like I was explaining Shy or me as 40-year-old novelist had sort of ideas about why Shy is feeling the way he did, I had to take that all out immediately. Now, that was all very bad writing and very fraudulent. And I suppose maybe the distance helped with that. A little bit into the kind of recent weird past, especially for the UK, who kind of gave themselves a lot of pats on the back for the Blair years. And I just want to sort of get at that moment before that. And is it a kind of curdled moment of hope, or is it a genuine change? So it just felt like a good distance. And I need a bit of distance. I started it writing Shy as a character in a medieval drama.
Really? Wow.
And yeah, he was a medieval manuscript illuminator who was putting in the margins of his pages sort of sacrilegious doodles, and then finding that the people paying for the manuscripts were rather liking that, and it becomes a sort of thriller of the illuminated manuscript world. I put that in a drawer, and I'm going to do something else with it. But he was the same. The boy was the same. That kind of inability to verbalize his pain. That kind of sense that every time he does verbalize his pain, he feels so guilty that he may as well not exist. That kind of desire to tunnel into oneself, you know, that kind of pre-linguistic hum of despair. It's historically non-specific, I hope. Just trying to write truthfully about how people feel. And then you've got to land on a time, you know, as a novelist, you've got to think like, right, I'm committing to this. and then when I turned on the music, I was like, okay, I'm in. This is my moment. This is my time.
Fantastic. I think we can always expect something very ambitious from you, Max, and people would have got a sense when they heard the reading at the beginning of this interview about the kind of poetic, sparse approach you bring to this novel. Last time we spoke, you were telling me about the fact that you have to keep it fresh, you have to give yourself new challenges. I was keen to know what the rewards are that come from this sort of risky writing.
Well, you can count on a hatchet job in the Sunday Times, in which they'll demolish your entire life and personality. So that's one of the joys. That's coming like wrapped up in the Post with a pretty bow on it. I joke that you can count on a certain amount of kickback. It's pretentious. That it's sentimental, that it's eccentric, etc. Those sorts of things that the kind of muscular culture are threatened by. And I find that super, super interesting. One of the things is a kind of unfinishedness. Like, I don't feel the books are finished by me. I feel they're finished by the reader. And I have that in mind when I'm writing, and I have that in mind kind of broadly philosophically as an artist. I've always felt that. And I'm super interested in work across different forms that does that. But then when you find out that's actually true, it's really astonishing. So when I took this book out onto the road, I insisted, and my publisher and various different festivals and venues and booksellers have been super supportive, that I wanted to do it all as collaborative events. So every single reading I've done has been a different abridgment of the book with a different musician or actor or cast of actors or teenage boy or sampler or double bass player or whatever. You know, they've all been really different. And as a result, every single event has been a completely bespoke encounter with the audience. And then when the audience show it back to me in their questions and in their responses and in what they say to me in the signing queue, it is mind-blowing how different it is from the night before or how different it is to what my intentions are, because it is a living, Shai is a living proposition. Like, he means something completely different to you than he does to, you know, my friend Kate. Like, it's an astonishing reminder as a writer to be humble in the proposition, like to not seek to control the moral or emotional climate of the weather system of the book, because that would be like a kind of a trap, really, that would limit its potential. Like, you have to put it out and let people do their thinking about it, particularly with a book like Shai, which invites you to think, you know, is he self-indulgent? Is he self-obsessed? Is he profoundly vulnerable? Is he damaged? Is he lovable, etc.? So yeah, what I found with that approach is just that the rewards are like beyond me. They're out there in the world, and I find that really, really heartening. And maybe sort of especially in the days of, you know, content beamed into our faces on tiny screens all day, the fact of a novel still being quite a radical proposition, I'm sure we talked about this with the Bacon, that it's still kind of an amazing thing for a person to sit in their body holding a physical thing and give it a few hours of their life and then find that it's in them to go off and think with and feel with. I find that ever more extraordinary. And it kind of makes me feel that the next experiment needs to be completely different again. I'm going to write something completely different next time because I want to raise the stakes for myself. I want to try something. I want to try this in a completely different style and see if I can still have this openness, have this this novel as a kind of question machine for its audience. Yeah, so that's a sort of rambling answer. But yeah, the answer would be that I love how I don't know what it's going to be.
Max Porter, I really enjoyed this book. It's called Shai. It's published by Faber and Faber. It's been such a treat to talk to you again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really very grateful. I appreciate it. And sorry about a little bit of Barcelona street noise in the background.
Now you're going to meet another troubled young boy, this time in rural Appalachia. He goes by the name of Demon Copperhead. Now, you might have already read this one. Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver was released in 2022. This year, though, it has won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, sharing the prize with Trust by Hernan Diaz. Demon Copperhead is a modern retelling of the Dickens classic David Copperfield. I spoke to Barbara Kingsolver when the book was released, and I started by asking her about her relationship with the original text.
Well, I have always, most of my life I've had a very good relationship with Charles Dickens. He's not a hugely important part of the canon in the US, but every American kid who gets through high school will probably read either Great Expectations or A Tale of Two Cities. If you're in AP, you know, like if you're an honor student, you might read both. And then for most Americans, that's it. We move on and don't really ever return to Dickens, mostly because we were too young to read those texts in high school. They're daunting. But I learned to be a writer by being a reader. I didn't go the conventional route. I didn't study writing or even literature in college. I studied biology. I was going to be a scientist. And in graduate school, again, I studied ecology and evolutionary biology, but I always loved reading and I always loved writing. I just thought it was going to be the thing that I did, you know, in private on my own time. I didn't imagine that I would get to make a living this way, which is so great. It's the most fun thing in the world to make up stories for a living. But that's all to say that I learned my craft from reading, and I have always relied heavily on the great plotters, and Dickens is the best. I mean, you just can't beat Dickens for a good plot. So I can't even remember when I first read David Copperfield. It didn't necessarily make a huge impression on me, but it always lodged in my brain as Dickens's favorite of his own novels. And as I got a little older and more kind of aware of the world, I understood why.
So why did you understand? What did you discover about this text?
Well, it's his own story. He grew up poor. He had a very close and involved relationship with the poorhouse, the debtor's prison where his father went. He was shuttled back and forth. Child labor was his norm, his world. He worked in a shoeblack factory. He grew up knowing the inside of institutional poverty, and I grew up. I was luckier than Charles Dickens. My father did not go to debtor's prison, but I grew up among very poor people. Appalachia is the poorest part of this country, and it's for 200 years, it's really been treated as a colony of the United States. It's been exploited economically, and its schools have been kept deliberately substandard, and its people have been kept deliberately poor by the series of outside agencies that came in to pull out the coal, the timber, the tobacco, all the resources. So when you grow up, you just think your world is the world. But as I got older and understood more about history and economics and sort of this deliberate institutional poverty, I began to understand that, you know, I grew up in a kind of Dickensian world.
Is it daunting to take on a text like David Copperfield and say, I'm going to put my stamp on this. I'm going to tell this story my way.
Well, it probably should be, but I'm sort of foolishly undaunted by I fools rush in where angels dare not tread. But it's funny that the way I came to David Copperfield was different from how you might expect. I had decided already that I wanted to write about the subject of this novel, about Appalachia, institutional poverty, what it does to kids, and more specifically, the prescription drug abuse epidemic, the opioid epidemic that we are living through right now. And it started in 96 when Purdue Pharma rolled out OxyContin, which they, swore was not addictive. Well, they did more than swear. They made up scientific evidence to prove what was false, what was obviously false. And they looked at the metrics and they chose this area, my exact region, specifically Lee County, which is just two counties to the west of where I live. But they chose this whole region as one of three target areas to pour in their painkillers because they have the metrics to understand how vulnerable we are. There's a high number of injured people because of the heavy industries, the mining industries, a lot of people on disability, and doctors who are stretched really thin because their patients may only have they don't have sick leave, they may not have transportation, these doctors may see their patients once a year. So they can't refer them to physical therapy and all of the other things. These doctors really can only prescribe a pill. And then Purdue just created this whole reward system to get these doctors to prescribe OxyContin. And within 5 years, we had one of the highest addiction rates in the country. We have opioid overdose deaths just like mounting. And we have this whole generation of kids growing up orphaned, being raised by grandparents or the foster care system, wards of the state, because their parents are incarcerated or dead or non-functioning. So this is where I live. This is the beautiful place where I live has been plagued by sort of many kinds of exploitation. I saw this as the latest in this long line of exploitation. So I wanted to write about it, but then there is this. Who wants to read about it? Mm. I mean, addiction has terrible stigma. A lot of people have already made up their minds, you know, about blaming the victim. These are just, you know, weak, bad people. They should be in prison, whatever. There's just not a lot of sympathy for the story I wanted to tell. So I spent several years trying to find my way in to the story I wanted to tell. And I... It happened in the strangest way. I was finishing a book tour in London in the UK, and I had a free weekend before I flew home, and I booked myself into Bleak House, which had been turned into an inn, like a country inn out in Broadstairs. I just thought, you know, that sounds fun. It's the Bleak House where Dickens used to live. So I took the train out there and walked into this creaky old mansion on the top of on a cliff overlooking the sea on the stormy weekend. And, you know, little Dorrit was there limping around to take my bag upstairs. And I could feel Dickens still in this house. And I was the only guest, so they gave me the run of the place. And here was Dickens's study and his desk. And they said, sure, you can sit in there. So I spent a long evening sitting at his desk, sort of communing with Dickens. And he said, you have to tell this story, but let the kid tell the story. Let the child tell the story. So right on that desk where Dickens wrote David Copperfield, I began writing my version of his story.
Wow. I love in the acknowledgements of your book, you talk about Charles Dickens and say you've come to think of him as your genius friend. Has the conversation continued?
I didn't let him write a review. I kind of finished off by thanking him in the acknowledgements. And I mean, he's still here, but I haven't spent a lot of worry, you know, wondering, would he approve of what I've done? I just picture him chuckling, because who wouldn't? If somebody, you know, 150 years from now decides to do a retelling of the Poisonwood Bible or the Bean Trees or one of my other novels set in the year, shall we say, 2275, you know, if there are still people writing, if there are humans writing and reading books by them, I would be thrilled if they wanted to do a retelling of my book.
So the hero of your novel is a boy called Damon, but everyone calls him Demon. Demon uh-huh. knows that people outside Appalachia would call him a hillbilly. Tell me, Barbara, yeah. What's your relationship to this word, hillbilly?
Well, as insiders, you know, sort of we use it casually, and it wasn't until I was 18 and went away to university and lived outside of this region that I understood how people look down on us, how the whole nation and I suppose the world condescends to us. And they're, you know, going all the way back to, you know, 1960s television, I guess, the Beverly Hillbillies. People of our region are portrayed as these ignorant idiots who hold our jeans up with a rope and have a pig in the house for a pet and, you know, shoot the neighbor's lights out if they're bothering us. And, you know, just this, I mean, of course, I was familiar with the Beverly Hillbillies, and we just thought, oh, that's hilarious. We just thought it was, you know, a big joke, and I didn't understand until I left the region that people imprint on that as who we really are. I mean, it was so far-fetched to us as kids. We didn't imagine anybody would sort of let this seep into their consciousness as a portrait of a people. But sure enough, when I went away to school, people made fun of my accent. I mean, people I didn't even know would stop me on the sidewalk to get me to say that one up there. And I mean, you can hear my, I lost my accent because I got tired of being ridiculed. And, you know, even to this day, I have met journalists who remark that, oh, my fingernails are clean. I mean, it is not over. It is as bad now as it ever was, that the world looks down on hillbillies as, well, now there's actually the extra layer of bigotry that's presumed, that we are very backward and it makes me mad. And that's a part of why I wrote this novel. I wanted to show, yes, that we have problems, but we are nuanced, interesting people with our honor codes and our resourcefulness and our pride.
Damon, or Demon, actually says, well, he's quite great, actually. He says the term hillbilly is a superpower. How is it a superpower for him?
Right. Now that, you know, sort of as we've all grown up and with television understood how outsiders are using that word against us, we use it as an identifier. It's sort of like, okay, you call me that. We can use it ourselves in, it's sort of an ironic but a powerful way. I have a good friend who has a podcast called Hillbilly Solid. I mean, we use it as a term of internal solidarity. But, you know, when I go on the road, I don't introduce people by saying, hi, I'm a hillbilly. If it comes up, I say hillbillies look a lot of different ways, and we all wear shoes.
There's a line I want to just read from the book where Damon says, all down the years, words have been flung like pieces of shit, only to get stuck on a truck bumper with up yours pride. Rednecks, moonshiners, rudge runners, hicks, deplorables. Barbara, that last word, deplorables, this is a very deliberate choice of word by you to put in this book.
Yes, it was. And I took it out and I put it in and I took it out and I put it in and I decided to leave it because, yes, I suppose in Australia, you know, as well as we do here, that Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, I'm a great fan of Hillary and I voted for her and I've actually, you know, had dinner with her and I think she's wonderful. But she made a mistake, as many, many progressive urban people do, in using words to write off rural people. And it's a huge political problem in my country now that, I'm a political progressive. I don't know what, you know, I don't know how these terms translate, but I voted for Joe Biden, and the former president, whose name will not be mentioned, is an anathema to me and to my region. However, I understand why so many of my neighbors, you know, and so many people in this region voted for him. We are really tired of the arrogance of urban progressives who see the world entirely through a progressive lens and don't see rural people at all. You know, we never show up in the movies or on television or in the news unless it's as an object of pity or a joke, a stupid joke. And that's liberals. That's not conservatives. That's liberals writing us off. It's just assuming we're just a bunch of people marrying our sisters and, you know, and being dumb. So, yeah, I wanted to put a little frisson, a little bit of discomfort into Demon's anger, because that's how we've gotten here. That's why so many rural people are ready to vote for an absolute, you know, hand grenade of a politician, because they're just really tired of being ignored and they're ready to just blow up the system in hope of something better, of being seen.
Wow. Barbara Kingsolver, I do want to get into the book a little bit more. I've said our hero is Damon, or Demon. His mum dies when he's so young, dies of a prescription drug overdose. And he just goes from hardship to hardship. People who've read David Copperfield maybe get a sense of where this is going. How tied did you feel to the structure of the Dickens novel when you were shaping Damon's story?
Tied to the mast with ropes. I interviewed a lot of people in the foster care system, in DSS and Child Protective Services, to find out, like, what's kind of the worst thing you see in the foster care system? And so I was able to mine the reality of the system, which is just, I mean, and don't get me wrong, there are wonderful foster parents who do it for the right reason. But they're not nearly enough foster parents at all. And so the system is so overstretched that there are plenty of people who just take in foster kids for the labor they can get out of them and for the $500 a month or whatever it is that the system pays them to take care of these kids, and they don't use it to take care of the kids. So I was able to find, you know, the equivalent of the School for Indigent Boys and the dangerous friend that David Copperfield met at his boarding school was named Steerforth. Well, I made the dangerous friend a high school football hero star named Fast Forward, and he meets Demon in this farm, this terrible foster home, and Fast Forward, of course, leads him astray. So you see what I mean? It's a little complicated to explain, but my plot parallels David Copperfield in ways that you will, if you read both, you'll say, oh, wow, it's kind of like an inside joke. But that I just let Dickens lead me through this plot and got more and more creative about, you know, finding modern equivalents of child labor that really exist here where I live, and modern equivalents of those terrible institutions, those Victorian institutions that still exist where I live in some, you know, more modern form. So I knew all along where Demon was going to land. And if you've read David Copperfield, you will know where he's going to land. I mean, if you begin to trust that, yes, Barbara really is following this river all the way to its end, you'll know who he's going to end up with and why and how. There will be plenty of surprises along the way. But this, I suppose, was a little gift to my reader. And I also realized sort of halfway through why Dickens told me, let the kid tell his own story. Well, there are many reasons. One is it's very compelling. When the kid is telling his story, you're sort of instantly on his side, and you trust this naive voice is sort of telling the truth about how bad things are. You're kind of willing to listen because they haven't become jaded as adults. They're not trying to manipulate you. They're just telling you, you know, what they're going through. So there's the trust, but there's also the reader's trust that this kid is going to make it. He's going to survive. He's going to make it through all these horrible things, kind of one after another, because he's telling you the story. He must have gotten through to the end to be able to tell you the story.
He does go through so much, though, on the way to that end. You know, there's poverty, family violence, he's orphaned, he's used as labour, as you've talked about. The pain goes on and on. As an author, what's it like to put this boy that you clearly love through so much?
It's terrible. It's terrible. It was so hard. I think that I spent more dark months in the 3 years I was writing this novel, more dark days, dark weeks, and dark months than I have probably in any novel I've written before. I've certainly had dark hours and dark days and scenes that I wanted to avoid writing in previous novels. But this one was like whole chapters and sections of his life that I had to, you know, I had to go to my desk and ask myself, okay, what am I going to do to poor Demon today? And I'm so grateful that my life is really happy. I have a wonderful marriage. I have wonderful kids. I have two adult daughters who, you know, live nearby, and two little grandchildren who are the lights of my life, who I see all the time. So it was really therapeutic for me to end my workday, go down to the kitchen, talk to my husband, who would give me a hug and say, remember, you know, it's okay. It's going to be okay. And we would go for a lot of long walks. But yes, it's hard. As an author, you invest deeply in your characters. You have to learn to love all of them, even the bad ones. You have to really get inside of them and understand that they're doing their bad things, but they think they're good. You know, they say, like, everybody thinks they're doing the right thing, even if it's evil. So, you know, if you don't invest that way in your characters, it shows on the page. Your readers won't invest either. So I had to put, like, the chapters where Demon runs away, he feels like he's got nothing left to lose. So he's going to run away and try to find this grandmother that's sort of legendary, but he doesn't even know if she exists. And he has only hints to where she lives. So he runs away and he goes through the terrible things that runaway teenagers go through. He gets robbed at a truck stop. He gets, you know, just sort of everything he has is taken from him and he's in danger. And, you know, he understands he could get run over on this road and nobody would know his name. He has no identification because he's, you know, he's only 12. He doesn't have any, you know, a driver's license or anything to tell people even who his, what is, you know, what his corpse would be named. So he, you know, to put him through that was terrible. I'm a mother, you know, and I do understand that my children are real and my characters are not, but there's this permeable boundary, but, you know, in your psyche between yourself and your characters, that's just profoundly painful when you're inventing, you know, terrible, terrible hardships for them. But, you know, at the end of the day, I could always blame Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens was wonderful at names, and you get to kind of riff on those names in this book.
Right.
I think right. You've exceeded yourself with a character called Maggot Peggot. Are there any are there any other names you're particularly proud of for inventing in this book?
Well, it really helped a lot that in this region, everybody goes by a nickname. Well, males. It's so common for boys and men to pick up nicknames, and they're never flattering. You know, Stubby, Shorty, Pork Chop, you know, just... It's just a thing of this culture, and I suppose other cultures might have it too, especially rural cultures, but people pick up nicknames. So that helped me in writing this book, that the names are reflections, you know, of Dickens's names. So, you know, Demon Copperhead, obviously, is David Copperfield. Steerforth becomes Fast Forward. That's his nickname. He's an athlete. You know, people call him Fast Forward. Then I came one that was a real puzzler, Uriah Heep. If you've read David Copperfield, you know that Uriah Heep plays a really important role. He's a sinister character, and as he is in my book. And so I've really puzzled all over that one. Well, Heep, you know, I pictured a heap of things is a pile of things, and piles or pile is a common last name here. So I thought his last name will be Pile. So what's Uriah Heep's first name going to be? And I came up with U-Haul. It has to start with U. And I don't know if this exists in your country, but U-Haul is it's a trailer company. You rent these U-Haul trailers. It's U-H-A-U-L. And so this guy, he's the assistant to the coach, and he hauls everything around for the team. So everybody calls him U-Haul. So yes, Uriah Heep became U-Haul Piles. Oh. And the thing is, if you read this, you know, we're talking about all these little sort of Easter eggs or, you know, private jokes between myself and Dickens. I mean, if you haven't read Dickens, you won't know any of this. You'll just say, oh, that's a good name. And that's a good name. But they were all born out of the forehead of David Copperfield.
This year's Pulitzer Prize winner, Barbara Kingsolver, congratulations. Demon Copperhead has even more awards buzz around it. It has been shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction, and the winner of that award will be announced on the 14th of June. And I should say that interview with Barbara came from our book show archive. There is so much good stuff there. At this point, I really have spoken to so many of the world's greatest living authors. So you can find all our old shows on the ABC Listen app. Look for your favourite author. They might be listed there. This has been the book show made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. My name is Claire Nichols, and this show is produced by Sarah Lestrange. Bye.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.